I warned you yesterday that I would talk about something completely different today. And this is work actually done by, again, mostly by Ilya Elfimov. Yanoki was the same Yanoki as Nagato referred to, was very much involved in some model calculations. And, you know, generally, we think that all magnetic materials, or most of them, have to be made of transition metals or rare earths or something like this. And maybe some of us have forgotten that actually oxygen in its solid state is also magnetically ordered, and have perhaps also forgotten that the O2 molecule actually has a triplet ground state, and the energy splitting to the singlet is actually quite large. And maybe if you would go back, actually it surprised me when I did go back and looked at what the Hund's rule coupling would be in oxygen if I had two holes in oxygen, for example, what would be the energy difference between the singlet and triplet, and you find out that it's actually larger than the transition metal material. So the Hund's rule coupling is of order 1 to 1.3 electron volts in oxygen. That tells you that if you could do some strange things, that you can actually make a material in which you would have holes in the oxygen band of a sufficient density and of a sufficient nature, and I'll come back to that in a second, then perhaps you could make very interesting ferromagnetic materials based on oxygen. So let me first of all, though, very briefly go on, because we had discussions yesterday, and this is there's two ways of doing this. This magnetism, one way is to use the surface effects, and the other way is to use point defects. And we talked, it was mentioned, you know, in the photoemission talks yesterday, there was a lot of talk about what happens at the surface. And I just would like to remind you that dramatic things can happen at the surface. especially in a charge transfer gap type of material, because ordinarily in charge transfer gap material you have a U, you know, and you have a charge transfer energy where you move an electron from oxygen to the transition metal or whatever it is, and remember that the U can be screened more in the solid than it can at the surface, so indeed you expect larger correlations on the surface as mentioned, but don't forget the charge transfer energy. It is actually given by the sum of the modeling potentials. Because I have to move a charge from a, you know, from an unfavorable region to an unfavorable region, you might say, or from a favorable region to an unfavorable region. And that modeling potential is huge in ionic materials. And when you go to the surface, obviously it's quite a bit lower. So you can actually change your material from a Mott Hubbard insulator in the bulk to a charge transfer gap insulator on the surface by simply choosing a correct surface. And those changes are huge. I'll show you some calculations. Generally, you know, you have this picture of Mott Hubbard, and then you have a charge transfer gap here, and the point is that this gap here can be modified greatly at the surface. We've actually done measurements to show that that is the case in simple model compounds like magnesium oxide, Salvatore Alteri. These are publications in PR, PhysRev, and so on. Let's look at nickel oxide first of all. Nickel oxide, LDA, you know it's a metal, and LDA and simple LDA, if you do spin polarized LDA, then you do get a small gap of something like 0.2 or 0.3 electron volts, much too small. But if you do LDA plus U, you actually open up this gap, you get the antiferromagnetic ground state right, and things like that. So let's look at LDA plus U in a slab calculation. And actually, Sascha Lichtenstein has published, I think, the 100 surface of nickel oxide before in this kind of scheme. Well, actually, the 100 surface, so this is a slab calculation with 8 layers. The 100 surface, the bulk, would have a gap corresponding to approximately this thing here. On the 100 surface, you actually get a sharp bound state, which is due to the crystal field splitting of the n plus 1 electron states, which are the d9 states. And actually, the gap hasn't changed terribly much from bulk. When you go to the 100 surface, though, then things change quite a bit. you actually get states, d electron addition states, which are as low as about 1 electron volt. So your gap has decreased by something like 2 or so electron volts, which is a huge amount. And this should really be a very important part of the surface of a 110 surface of nickel oxide. You can go on and do all kinds of other surfaces. There's one extreme surface that you could look at, and that is the polar surface. So if you look at a rock salt structure, and if you look at the 111 surface, then it's polar because it's charged. It consists of either the transition metal, or in this case I do it with magnesium oxide, say, or it consists of oxygen. So these are alternating layers, 2 plus 2 minus, 2 plus 2 minus, 2 plus 2 minus, and that has actually an infinite surface energy and it can't exist. However, it does exist. These are the nickel oxide 111 layer growth are the exchange biasing layers that one uses in the giant magnetoresistive materials. It can't exist, but somehow or other it does. And you can stabilize it in various ways. You can either reconstruct the surface atomically, forming pyramids, 100 pyramids, places on a pyramid, or you can cover the layer with a monolayer of a monovalent material. So in fact, what happens when you grow these things in a 111 direction in really good vacuum, you still have enough water around that an OH group actually forms on the surface and the crystal grows under it. OH is 1 minus, not 2 minus. And that is kind of a surfactant that stabilizes that surface. And just to show you how that physics goes, very briefly, here's what happens if you didn't have any kind of reconstruction or stabilization, just 2 minus to 2 plus 2 minus layers. And if you looked at this, you would find that the potential energy on these 2 plus layers would in fact change by something like 58 volts per layer if you had this kind of geometry. So that's completely impossible because that's bigger than the gap, much bigger than the gap. So this thing won't exist. However, by just taking 1 electron from here and putting it over there, and you're going to see what I'm going to do, right? Take 1 electron from there and put it on the other side, or exactly the same thing happens, and that's the picture I'll show you. If you just take away this layer so that you have oxygen here and there, but then make this 1 minus and that also 1 minus. The physics is the same. Then you have nicely closed all the electric field lines, and your surface is stable, your material is stable. So by electronically reconstructing, taking an electron from the outermost oxygen layer and putting it onto the transition metal, or adding another oxygen layer of 1 minus on the other side, you're going to have a perfectly stable 111 system. Of course, that costs you energy to do that, and it's all a matter of whether or not you can make this. But if you can make this, obviously, there's a good chance that it'll be a metal, right? Oxygen, the oxygen band has now crossed the chemical potential. It's got one hole per oxygen. It'll be a metal. And interesting enough, if you do the calculation, so this is just, again, the same slab calculation, but now just with simple LDA or LSDA, and it's done for magnesium oxide, not nickel oxide, so we've gotten rid of all magnetism. And the band structure changes from a huge gap. The magnesium oxide has a gap, a conductivity gap of about 8 electron volts. Actually, in LSDA, it turns out to be about 6 electron volts. But if you look at this slab with 111 surface, with 111 layers, and we have 4 layers, and this is the spin-up part, it turns out to be magnetic. Actually, we hadn't noticed that at first. This is now the magnesium sp band, which now crosses the chemical potential because you have added one electron to the magnesium on that surface, and it is localized only on the surface. If you ask where these electrons are, they're only on the surface, on one of the surface of the magnesium oxide. This is the oxygen band, spin up on the opposite layer, the oxygen layer. It's not, as a matter of fact, this couldn't possibly be the answer to the to everything, because this would not be charge neutral, right? Because I've taken electrons, put electrons on magnesium, but not taken them away from anything. But let's look at the minority, at the majority, at the minority spin direction, and there you go. Now the oxygen bands cross the chemical potential like this. The magnesium is the same as it was. It really doesn't change. So the magnesium layer is not magnetically ordered, or very, very weakly. But the oxygen layer is in fact a ferromagnet in this calculation, a ferromagnet with a huge exchange splitting of the bands of about 0.3 electron volts. And that has to do with the Hund's rule coupling on oxygen. Okay, now whether or not this is really true and can really happen is something that has to be seen experimentally, because you have other competing effects like the chemistry effects and other reconstructions that you can have. But we are quite confident that these things can be made, and we're trying very hard, and other people are trying very hard to actually make them. The only way to actually make them is to make them thin enough and to grow them on epitaxially so that some substrate stabilizes this kind of a one-on-one crystal structure. So epitaxy is the important thing. So let's now go. Now that we found that actually the oxygen exchange interactions or Hund's rule couplings are large or whatever, let's go to another way. And so we dreamt up another way of perhaps making a ferromagnet. And this is to take simple calcium oxide or strontium oxide or magnesium oxide and put point defects into it. Remove some of the calcium or remove some of the oxygen. So this is the band structure of calcium oxide. There's a gap, well, in band theory of about 4 electron volts. Actually, it turns out to be, I think, 4.8 volts in reality. But nonetheless, a nice gap. This is just LDA or LSDA. It doesn't matter in this case. Now let's make, let's do another calculation where you add 3%. You remove 3% of the calciums or 3% of the oxygens. Very small concentration of vacancies. If you take out 3% of the oxygens, then of course you have electrons now at the chemical potential in the calcium SPD bands. Okay, so there are electrons in an otherwise empty band. If you remove 3% calcium, you get holes on the oxygen band to compensate this, at least if you can keep the amount of oxygen constant. And we now know that you can do this. However, there's something much more interesting that actually happens. Again, if you take the oxygen vacancies, which is the easiest thing to do, so you get electrons on the calcium, it is not magnetic. No signs of any magnetic order. The non-magnetic state is the lowest energy state in LSDA. But if you take out calcium so that you have holes in the oxygen, you get, in fact, a half-metallic ferromagnet. You have two holes per unit cell, now two holes per calcium, or I should say two holes per calcium impurity, and in fact they cross the chemical potential for spin down, and the spin up is a perfectly good insulator. Now why is that? Well, actually there's some really pretty physics involved, at least I think there is, in why this happens. And the physics goes like as follows. In an octahedron like this, if you have a vacancy here, say a calcium vacancy, and these are oxygens, then of course there will be a strong negative potential binding those holes to that vacancy. And those holes will therefore be in some linear combination of oxygen p orbitals around about that vacancy. This is important. I want to localize things. I have to do that to give me this weak moment ferromagnetism. The p orbitals that are most likely to be occupied are the ones with lobes pointing towards, occupied by holes with lobes pointing towards that center. Simple crystal field theory. Actually, this theory was actually done before the calculation, by the way. But it doesn't matter. So we'll point those lobes toward the oxygens, and now we can make various linear combinations. Remember, oxygen bandwidths are fairly large, so we have to include the oxygen-oxygen hopping integrals, just like in the high PCs. And we will include the hopping integrals, the sigma and the pi hopping integrals, and the oxygen. And there's various symmetries of states that you can produce. These are the EG states, very familiar from the high TCs, x squared minus y squared, or 3z squared minus r squared. Okay, a linear combination of orbitals of 3z squared minus r squared symmetry. And this here is the totally symmetric state, the A1g. This is a T1u state, which is ungerade, and so on. You have all these states. And you might ask yourself, which is the lowest energy state if you put, first of all, a single hole into those? Well, the hopping integrals, we know what they are from band theory. And you have the sigmas and the pis, hopping integrals, and so on. And you can do this calculation almost on the back of the envelope. Not quite. It's a little bit too big. But what you find is that the lowest energy state for holes, for a single hole, is the doubly degenerate E state. And immediately, a light goes on, right? Because if you have the doubly degenerate E state as the lowest energy state, and I should have taken this slide here. So this state here, I haven't drawn the I've done this. I told you something that is not quite right. This is A1g. This one here is, I think, T2u. And the other component of this, the z squared minus r squared, has these orbitals occupied or those orbitals involved. And then, again, this one here, but with all of the phases the same. Okay, that's an x squared minus y squared. It's an S-type orbital in the plane. Those two orbitals are degenerate in octahedral symmetry, in this symmetry. And they are, in fact, the lowest energy state for removing one electron. However, the A1 orbital, the totally symmetric one, is the lowest energy one for electron addition. That's simple symmetry that has to do with signs of hopping integrals and so on and so forth. So when you take an oxygen, make an oxygen vacancy so that you would add an electron to the calciums, that electron would go into a non-degenerate A1g type orbital. And if you added a second electron to that and these things were bound, of course it has to go in with spin down. So you'll have a non-magnetic singlet state. However, with the doubly degenerate E state, the second hole that goes in can go in with spin parallel or spin antiparallel, and then something really interesting happens. I'll first show you the answer, and then I'll show you the physics. What happens is that the lowest energy state for U equals zero, U now is the oxygen hole-hole repulsion, which we know is about 6 electron volts. That's been measured by Auger spectroscopy many years ago. The triplets and the singlets are in fact degenerate for U equals zero. As soon as you switch on U and make U large, the singlets go up in energy or the triplets go down, and the ground state is a triplet. This is a molecular Hund-Sruell coupling. It's exactly the same physics as atomic Hund-Sruell coupling. If you make U large, these electrons automatically avoid each other. They don't come onto the same site, and that actually you can also do by making their spins parallel, right? it's exactly the same physics. It's molecular Hund's rule coupling. And you find out that the triplet state is the lowest energy state. Now you have these rather d-local objects, which in 3% actually still have a considerable overlap with each other because they are so d-local. And they form local triplets, which in fact are ferromagnetically exchange coupled, to give you the long range order. Why does this actually happen? Well, I'll show you a little example and you can go home and do this little trick or get your students to do it for you, because you've probably forgotten how, like me. Let's take a triangle. This is in Hank Eskes's thesis, 1994, where we look at two particles in a Hubbard model on different kinds of chains, okay, be it circles, be it linear chains, and different kind of symmetries. And you find out this Hund's rule coupling, which tells you that sometimes the singlet state is the ground state, sometimes the triplet. But the triplet is a ground state for this case of this octahedron, even though U goes to infinity. Now those electrons or those holes don't feel each other at all anymore, right? So why in all the world would they form a triplet state? Because I've put in no inter-site exchange. How can it happen? This is how it happens. If I have a triangle with two electrons, one will spin up here, and I'll put the other electron on with spin down. So it's three atoms, okay? And let's now set up our Hamiltonian matrix. Well, we can hop this electron over to this site. I have U as infinity. U is infinity, so they can never be on the same site. Okay, this electron can hop over here, giving me that. And the hopping integral is T. Then this electron can hop over there, giving me another hopping integral, T. Then this electron can hop over there, giving me another hopping integral, T. And this state is actually the same as that. Well, is it? Right, it's not. Almost. Actually, if you did this for the singlets, do not a, you know, half a triplet and half a singlet, but did it for the singlet, you would find that these two are the same. Because the singlet is antisymmetric with interchange of the spins, but not interchange of the spatial part. So then, so that would connect this to that via hopping integral T. But the triplet, the interchange of the spatial part means the sign changes. And there, you will connect this with that, but with a minus sign. So this has absolutely no interactions in it, except U is infinity and Pauli. And it provides you with an answer to the molecular Hund's rule coupling, which tells you that depending on the sign of the hopping interval, whether you have electrons or holes, and depending on, we know that these signs are different, it depends on whether you have an even number or an odd number in your ring, so it depends on the topology, but you can get very large singlet triplet splittings because of this mechanism, which simply has to do with the symmetry of the wave function. This is actually the physics behind the U dependence of, this is actually the real physics behind this U dependence of the singlet triplet splitting, except in an octahedron, things are much more complicated, and actually they can get around each other there because there are paths, you know, where they can hop around each other. But still, in the end, if you do the calculation, this is the physics behind the energy difference between the singlet and the triplet. And that energy difference is now actually, I kind of misled you at the beginning, saying that you needed a Hund's rule coupling for the oxygen. Well, actually you don't. Because these holes never get onto the same oxygen with U as infinity or U as large. But actually, the splitting is caused by the kinetic energy term. It's purely a matter that the triplet, you have to go twice around before you come back to the same wave function. It looks like it's in a bigger box. Whereas in the singlet, you only go once around and you're back to the same wave function. It's in a smaller box, and therefore it has a higher kinetic energy. And this is the physics also behind the octahedral part. Aside from this simple model of the triangle, you can read about this. You can never put simple models into PRL, so aside from the model, you can read all this in PRL in a couple of weeks. Thank you.
So we have time for two or three questions.
People, yes?
I understand that the electron in your last example of the triangle can go around either clockwise or counterclockwise, so it has an orbital angular momentum too, is that correct?
In principle, yes. But unless you would include spin orbit coupling or things of this kind, I guess maybe that's not so important. But it could be with the application of a circularly polarized field, you could in fact do something. Okay, I don't know what are you alluding to.
I thought they were contributing to a moment.
Well. In principle, yeah, but these are still all real wave functions, and they're all real hopping integrals, at least within this picture. So there's no actual orbital moment involved, I guess, because those two states are degenerate. Now, maybe the degeneracy would lift in some ordered fashion. I don't know. That's not impossible. So maybe you're right. I hadn't actually thought of that, but you're perfectly right. There are two ways to go around. Like a flux phase type of. Yeah. George, sorry.
Do you have a feeling that what they're curing if it's not being
Yeah, I told you that this calculation was done with a defect concentration of 3%. Very small, which is very small. Now, whether or not you can get that in calcium oxide, I don't know, especially to try to get it with removing only calcium and not the oxygen. So it'll have to be, I think the only way to do it again is with epitaxy and then using thin film like methods too. So I would suggest, actually we're trying that, but so far in that particular thing we have succeeded in something else, but that particular thing hasn't worked yet. But what I think the thing to do is to do molecular beam epitaxy of calcium oxide on a calcium oxide substrate and then have an excess of oxygen and hope that you can get some defects that way. The Curie temperature is a much more difficult thing. Of course, density functional theory or LDA, things like that, always way overestimate Curie temperatures because they sort of put the Hund's rule coupling is what determines the Curie temperature there. So that splitting that you saw of the minority and majority spin bands was about 0.3 electron volts. Now, I wouldn't. That does not mean that that is a Curie temperature. I would estimate that the Curie temperature is somewhere, you know, maybe 100 or 200 degrees Kelvin, something like that. But I think still very substantial. Of course, this was also done on an ordered material. The calculation was a superlattice calculation, so we had to do it ordered. If you're disordered, of course, which would be probably what you would get, unless you can play some really fancy tricks, it'll be much lower. But of course, 3% is not much, so you could put in quite a bit more. One of the things that we were thinking of, and it's mentioned in the paper also, is that this might be the explanation for the low magnetic moments and the high Curie temperatures in the hexaborides. But also, if you take TiO2 and substitute the titanium with cobalt, titanium is 4+, cobalt is 2+, and it'll be compensated in exactly this way. Maybe the ferromagnetism, the high temperature, 800 degrees Kelvin, ferromagnetism with very low magnetic moments that some people say they observe, I'm saying that very carefully, in cobalt substituted titanium dioxide, 6%, maybe that is also due to this oxygen thing, and the cobalt is sort of, you know, a thing that is just misleading you. So people are now trying indeed experiments doing magnesium substitution for titanium and things of that kind. You know, whether this particular thing, this particular material is true or not, I don't really even care that terribly much. But I'm sure that we will find materials where we will be able to do this kind of physics and get very high transition temperatures and pretty small magnetic moments. But in spintronics, that doesn't really matter, right? The low moments, I mean.
So I think maybe we'll stop and catch him at the break, and you know, you guys can cluster around and